Standing counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Christopher Hanman for all the petitioners. This court's often recognized that notice and comment, as a practical matter, are the only defense a party has against agency decision-making. Congress recognized that was particularly true when EPA issues non-conformance penalties. That's because, by definition, an NCP alters the free market dynamics. It allows one party to play by one set of rules, and other parties had to play by an entirely different set. The only way to eliminate that inequity is to ensure that the penalty is set high enough. And to determine whether how high is high enough, Congress has mandated that EPA ask for that information. They did so in Section 206G of the Clean Air Act. It expressly requires that when EPA asks for this information, when it issues an NCP, it must do so following notice and comment. EPA's response on brief is that they acknowledge that there are some requirements that do entail notice and comment, and they recognize that when Congress, as in this case, has expressly demanded notice and comment, an agency cannot turn to the APA's good cause as an escape hatch. But what they say is that it only applies to some regulations, not all. It applies to just the initial formula that the agency came up with, not the NCPs that are then based on that formula. Now, there are several things that are wrong with that argument, not least of which is that it's an argument that's never been adopted by the agency, only unveiled for the first time by litigation counsel on brief. But we think there's an actually simpler way this court can resolve that threshold question. Even if EPA's interpretation is correct, that all that requires notice and comment is the formula was changed. The interim final rule squarely adopts a different standard for the upper limit. The upper limit is an element, a component.
When's the final rule going to be done? If the final rule were issued today, this case is mooted, right?
I don't think so. It's not moot for several reasons, one of which...
Before we get there, when will it be? Any idea? We're close, right?
We're asking the wrong person, Brad.
I suspect that's right.
I'm sorry.
In 15 minutes, you might get a better answer.
Okay, thank you.
What we do know...
Why isn't it mooted, then?
Well, it wouldn't be moot for two reasons. One reason is that the question about the upper limit, that was set by this interim final rule. Right now, if you go look at the online version of the CFR, that is already there. So that change has been in place. We don't know whether the final rule is going to revise that.
But if there were a final rule, the hypothesis of Judge Griffin's question hypothesized using a final rule. So what remedy is left that we could grant for anything that was defaulted on the interim final rule?
This declaring the interim final rule as arbitrary and capricious has important consequences because
That's what we're trying to find out. What are the consequences that would be left at that point?
Under this interim final rule, there have been two certificates of conformity that have been issued to Navistar. Those allow Navistar right now to be producing these engines under this 1900 NCP. There's currently a challenge pending in this court right now and another petition for review to those certificates of conformity. The very legitimacy of that challenge in many ways turns on the IFR. If the IFR is invalid, then so too are those certificates of conformity. That case is now being held in abeyance by this court pending out the disposition in this case. And I would also point out that...
What would be the remedy we could grant? Suppose the counsel for the government stands up and says, we finally got the final rule out today. What is the remedy left that we could grant at that point?
A declaration that the interim final rule was invalid.
Well, we can't grant advisory opinions.
A
declaratory judgment has got to carry a real-world consequence.
I agree.
In order to be valid under Article 3. So what is the real-world consequence that we could impose upon anybody if the final rule were to come out? Now, I'm not saying that I buy into the proposition that a pending final rule moots the case, but assuming it were no longer an hypothesis, what would be the real-world consequence of our declaration?
The declaration is that invalidates something that subsequent actions, the collateral consequences of those certificates of conformity, would now be invalidated.
What are the collateral consequences that we could still affect after the issuance of the final rule? Don't give me a general answer. Give me a specific answer.
The certificates of conformity that were issued in reliance on this interim final rule, mm-hmm. those certificates are currently allowing Navistar to produce engines. If this court...
But they wouldn't need those. Those would no longer be valid anyway if the new final rule issued, right?
Well, I think it depends on the nature of that new final rule. If that new final rule has a retroactive effect, and I think there are some serious questions about the legitimacy of EPA legislating...
That would be litigable under the final rule.
Perhaps.
Not under this rule.
I think what this... I think what these show, Judge Santel, is that these sort of imponderables, there's no doctrine of anticipatory mootness. Right now we have a live case or controversy. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. There is some...
Given EPA's history of timeliness in the past, it may not be a very good assumption to assume that it's going to become moot before we decide.
And I think we have more than just the soothing assurances now on brief that it's going to come. We have the EPA itself saying in the interim final rule that this interim final rule is in effect for two more years until the end of 2013. If there was a legitimate concern about getting this done quickly, there would have been no reason to have an interim final rule last for 2 years fully. I would also point out that there are two cases what this court has decided involving interim final rules where the final rule issued and yet this court still issued its determination, both in the Petrie case and in the Midtex case. Those are cases cited in the briefs. Both of those were instances in which that interim final rule was replaced ultimately in one case, in Petrie, for example, by a final rule that essentially cut and paste the language of that interim final rule, and yet this court didn't find a mootness issue there. But I do hasten to add that right now we are facing a true harm that satisfies Article 3, and no party has suggested there is any anticipatory mootness issues of any sort here. That gets to the merits of this question, which is, can EPA bypass notice and comment rulemaking when issuing these particular NCPs? What EPA says is they can, because all they're required to do, as far as notice and comment, is for the formula. But the formula depends on the upper limit. The upper limit has been changed by this interim final rule. Ever since the Phase 1 rulemaking, which EPA concedes had to have gone through notice and comment rulemaking, the upper limit was defined categorically as always the prior emission standard. That's no longer the case. In this interim final rule, they have now changed that definition so that the upper limit, EPA now has the discretion to come up with a different type of standard. That change necessarily requires notice and comment rulemaking. Section 551.5 of the APA defines rulemaking as not just the initial formulation of that rule, but any amendment or modification. And this court's decision in Paralyzed Veterans and Judge Griffith's recent decision in Northeast Hospitals Corporation recognizes that when an agency engages in an amendment to a rule that otherwise required notice and comment, so too does that amendment require notice and comment. We think that is the simplest way for this court to resolve the case because it doesn't require the court to even assess the merits of that interpretation. But I do think on the merits, that interpretation is wrong. And it's first wrong because EPA has never adopted this view. The first time it's come about is in this brief. It's not mentioned in the IFR, and if the EPA thought that it had a free pass, that notice and comment rulemaking were simply a matter of discretion, it would have presumably said so somewhere in the interim final rule. Instead, it assumed very logically that it had to provide that and spent some considerable effort trying to show why it had satisfied the good cause exception. In response to our petition for a stay pending review in this court that we directed to the agency, they didn't say your petition's denied because we have no obligation. It said again, as they echoed in the IFR, that there is simply a good cause exception.
But good cause exception, invoking that, suggests to me that they're not reading the statute the way you are, right? They're saying we don't have to do it, so we can go under the APA good cause exception. And we think that we can sustain that, right? So isn't that different from what you're arguing?
I don't think so. As I understand their argument, Judge Brown, they're saying that the APA good cause exception that they went through was sort of extra credit, that they had no obligation to provide any notice and comment in the first place. That's their view, that when you issue NCPs, there's simply no – that's at least the view they've adopted now in brief – that they do not have to at all ever provide notice and comment when issuing an NCP. They have said, though, that in the past they do so as a matter of discretion. Every time, and all the six times before where they have gone through notice and comment, it's been purely because they've decided to, not because they had to. And at here, they invoked the good cause exception. But their argument is that there is no good cause that's needed. Their argument is that they simply don't have to provide notice and comment. And our argument is that the statute doesn't say that. The statute says you must provide notice and comment. And the statute says that it's not limited to just the formula. 206G3, which defines the regulations that require notice and comment, say it's those regulations that, quote, provide for nonconformance penalties, end quote. And that's what you have here. You have regulations that are providing for nonconformance penalties. Hence, they require notice and comment. And at no point has the EPA ever suggested a contrary interpretation. Even under the good cause, though, I think they would fail that standard as well. What EPA has done here with respect to good cause is they've ignored this court's rule that the good cause exception is to be, quote, narrowly construed and only reluctantly countenanced. That standard, if it means anything at all, means that an agency cannot, at its whim, bypass note and comment procedures simply to bail out one manufacturer who invited the harm on itself. And that's a key point that EPA does not refute in its briefs. It doesn't deny that Navistar had all the information it needed to seek an NCP earlier. It doesn't deny that in the 2010 Dear Manufacturer letter, for example, at page 912 of the Joint Appendix, EPA said, we don't think, this is as of February 2010, we don't see any technological laggards developing. We don't think we're going to need to issue any nonconformance penalties. But we're open to reconsider that. So stand up now if you have a problem. Navistar still didn't, at that point, seek out those nonconformance penalties. It waited instead until the end of 2011 to do so. And there are two very important problems with that, not least of which is that, of course, it denies the agency an opportunity to engage in the very reasoned decision-making process that Congress envisioned, but it has a practical implication that exacerbates the degree of unfairness that these NCPs can sometimes provide. By waiting to the very end and then rushing the rulemaking process through, Navistar and the EPA have prevented other petitioners from deciding to use those same NCPs. The decisions about how to calibrate engines, how to line up those engines and produce those engines has to occur many, many months in advance. At this point, by waiting to the very end, all the other petitioners already have their 0.2 engines in place. Had they known a year ago earlier that they could rely on an NCP for the low, low rate of $1,900, they could have said, and this is set forth at paragraph 10 of the Gressler Declaration at page 47 of our addendum in our brief, could have said, we may very well have chosen to go that route. We'll go ahead and produce an engine at 0.5, not 0.2. It's a lot cheaper. You can get better performance, perhaps, and it allows us to take advantage. After all, NCPs are for anyone to choose. And by waiting to the very end, EPA has denied us that opportunity, and that only exacerbates the sense of inequity. Let me turn to the merits, too, even on the process. EPA's decision as a threshold matter that NCPs here were warranted violates the plain language of its own regulations. The trigger for an NCP exists only if there's, quote, substantial work, end quote, that needs to be done. The way EPA defines that is that there's substantial work will be required, not substantial work was required or not substantial work might have been required in the past. That gets to the very distinct difference between the parties. We say the regulation should be read to mean exactly what it says, that when EPA goes about making its determination about whether to issue an NCP, it asks, looking forward, does substantial work, will it be required? They say, no, we only look back at the initial time the standard at issue was promulgated. At that point, was substantial work necessary? Now, there are two reasons that can't possibly be the right interpretation. One, it's the past tense, not the future tense, and EPA can never harmonize that interpretation. But two, it would make no sense. Section 202 of the Clean Air Act, by definition, as this court has recognized, is by its nature a technology-forcing statute. Every emission standard necessarily is going to require substantial work. So at the time a new standard is issued, you will always have substantial work. If the standard was, well, years later, 9 years later, we'll look back and ask, well, was substantial work necessary when we first promulgated this? The answer will always be yes. And that makes the substantial work factor a meaningless prong. It will always be satisfied under the statute because it always presumes substantial work exists. The same is very true for technological laggard. Tech laggard is designed to prevent the very situation you have here, a competitor who, for purely economic and strategic reasons, has opted not to pursue a technology. They are using that technology, the SCR technology that all other manufacturers are successfully using. They're using it in Brazil, but they've chosen not to do it here. They've chosen for strategic reasons, and that's set forth very candidly in many of their own statements and annual reports. What they can't do is use bypass the notice and comment procedure, bypass the process Congress envisioned, bypass the very equities that Congress was concerned about in these NCPs, and say, well, by our own choice, we decide to do that. That gets to the very heart of what Congress was trying to do in carefully balancing the needs to protect true, honest technological laggards and the very, very real competitive concerns that all manufacturers who play by the rules face when a competitor of theirs can come in, continue to pollute at high rates 2.5 times what they are doing, and pay a rate that simply bears no resemblance.
But what's Navistar supposed to do now? Do they get the technology from someone else? Or?
One of the answers is absolutely, they can get it from themselves, Judge Griffith. They are using that exact same SCR technology for their own engines in Brazil. So it's not even something that they have to go out and
money.
I'm sorry?
They can spend the money.
Yes, they have to spend money, which is what we, of course, have done. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars developing this same technology. We're basically saying it's play by the rules here. And the idea that Navistar has been put at any disadvantage, that's unfortunately the history and recent headlines, J.P. Morgan perhaps, show companies make all sorts of ill-advised decisions, sometimes sadly to the detriment of employees or to their own balance sheets. But that can't possibly be justification for an agency to swoop in each time, declare a good cause, and bypass the very process that's designed to help protect the other members of the industry and the public at issue here. If there are no further questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Hearing none, we'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Michelle Walter with the Department of Justice, and I represent the Environmental Protection Agency. I also do have with me at council table Michael Horowitz from EPA's Office of General Counsel, and also Mr. Larry Levine, who is Navistar's counsel. Although Mr. Levine is not arguing today, he's asked me to let the Court know that he will be available for any questions if the Court should have any specifically for Navistar. I want to start with responding to some of the questions that the Court asked, and then also clearing up some inaccuracies that the petitioners have stated in their argument today. So basically, there are five areas that I want to cover. First, of course, I'll address the timing and mootness issue that Your Honors raised. Second, I'd like to address their point about the upper limit requiring notice and comment rulemaking and explain why that wouldn't have made a difference in this case. Third, I'll also address the inaccurate statement that EPA's position is that there are no procedures that apply.
There are no what?
That there are no procedures that would apply to NCPs. And fourth, I'll also address the lack of harm that petitioners have from this particular interim rule. And then finally, I'll move on to the last.
Are you claiming no standing?
No, we're not claiming any standard.
Then what is the lack of harm?
We're talking about the harmless error argument that we have at the end of our brief.
Before you get to that one, do you really think a harmless error argument is ever going to carry much weight in a notice and comment, a failure to give notice and comment?
Well, I think in this particular case it does, Your Honor, where EPA is actually in the process of considering the final NCP that will go into effect.
Well, in the process of and having issued two different things, but that's not really the question. Are we likely to establish a precedent that when an agency fails to give notice and comment, I'm not asking you to concede that you have notice and comment failure, but if you have a notice and comment failure, it's difficult for me to see how in all but the most radical cases you could ever prevail on harmless error. The whole purpose in notice and comment is to give the world a chance to say there's something wrong with this rule. And then to come in and say, well, no harm, there wasn't anything wrong with this rule, that sort of Doesn't sound like the sort of precedent we'd be likely to create, does it, counsel?
No, I understand your point, Your Honor, in two things with that. It is slightly different than, of course, arguing procedural harm from a standing perspective. But secondly, in this case, although EPA didn't provide formal notice and comment, they did contact the petitioners and ask them about various technologies that they were using, costs of those technologies, et cetera.
Okay, I got you off of your progress because of, but you had one more point you were going to.
Sure, the last point I'm going to cover is just the last point that Mr. Handman raised about the regulatory criteria on substantial work and technological laggards. So I do want to move into the question that Your Honor's raised about the timing and the mootness. As we stated in our briefs, EPA anticipates that they're going to complete their review of the final rule within the next couple of months, by the end of this month or beginning of June. Now, we don't know if OMB is going to review the rule at this point, but even if OMB does, we're still anticipating that the final rule could be issued sometime this summer or early fall.
Okay, wouldn't that be a good time to call this moot if we're going to call it moot instead of now?
Correct.
Once again, counsel, are we likely to call something moot on the basis of a rule that hadn't come out yet?
Are you likely to call it moot if it hasn't?
I think we're likely to call it moot.
I don't think the court's
you may want to move off of that one.
Okay, yes. Okay. But just, I did want to get to your remedy point, though. If the court does rule on the interim rule before the final rule is out, the remedy that would be available to the court is, assuming you ruled on some substantive issue in the interim rule, would be to issue an opinion on how EPA should have considered a particular aspect of the problem, which EPA could still do.
Assuming we hold that you agency should have proceeded with notice and comment rulemaking, would not the remedy be to abrogate the rule?
Would be
vacate the rule.
Yes, the remedy would be to vacate the rule.
Okay, thank you.
And I did want to move on to the upper limit point that Mr. Handman discussed. One thing that he said that is not correct is that EPA's formula changed in the interim rule. That's not true. The formula has not changed. There are various different technical abbreviations that go into the actual formula that I won't get into. And that's the same formula that EPA used here as it's done in its other prior NCP rulemakings. What did change is how EPA determined the upper limit for this particular rule. In the past NCP rulemakings, EPA has set the upper limit equal to what the prior emission standard was. But the reason they did that is because those particular NCPs were being issued at about the same time that the new or revised emission standard was being issued. So that made sense to make them be equal. But here we have some very unique circumstances where the revised emission standard wasn't coming into full effect for 9 years. So there was significant lag time during which manufacturers have proceeded along very different technological paths, with some making a lot more progress than others. So it didn't make sense for EPA to set the upper limit at the previous standard because that would have allowed backsliding by manufacturers. In other words, all manufacturers right now, including Navistar, are producing engines that will emit at a level of no greater than 0.5 grams. All manufacturers are emitting at that, have engines that can meet that level right now. So to set the upper limit at a level that is higher than that, the previous standard of 2.3, would have allowed any manufacturer who's going to use NCPs to have their engines emit at that level, which is more than four times higher than the 0.5 level that they can currently achieve.
Okay, now I confess to being mathematically challenged.
Me too.
But let me just ask you, how does that impact if you change the formula in that way, don't you in fact lose part of what would go into your calculation as to what that final number should be? In other words, the NCP, the level that you set, if you start halfway down the line, aren't you in fact discounting what the manufacturers who have in fact complied, what their costs were?
Sure, I understand that. And again, just to clarify, it's the upper limit is not part of the NCP formula per se. But if the court will allow me, I'd like to use kind of a demonstrative aid that's found in the joint appendix. If you can look on page 65 of the joint appendix, there's a table that I think might help explain this, and I'll give you a chance to get to that particular page.
Seem to have it up here. Maybe I do.
I can hold it up, but it's pretty small, so.
Okay, 65.
Yes, Joint Appendix, page 65.
That's Joint Appendix what?
Page 65, Your Honor.
Okay.
Do you have it?
It says Chapter 4, Regulatory Parameters. Is that
what? The Joint Appendix, page 65, I have, has this graph. Yes, that's
Joint
right.
Joint Appendix
sorry.
I have has numbers beginning with 900.
That's our supplemental Joint Appendix.
Okay.
This is in the initial appendix the petitioner submitted, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
So bear with me while I try to explain this.
Let me ask you before you do that, why are we pursuing this route? What is the gist of the argument you're now making?
That even if we had done as petitioners suggest and set the upper limit at what the previous standard was, it wouldn't have made a difference in this case.
Okay, now the real question is, should you have given notice and comment? Did you fail to give notice and comment? The fact that had they done so, you might have come out the same way, doesn't seem to me to decide this case. It appears that EPA didn't give notice and comment.
What are you referring to?
That's true, isn't it?
Yes, on the rulemaking.
No notice and comment.
Correct.
Okay. Now, we could pursue these numbers and maybe they would be interesting, but you still would not have given notice and comment.
That's correct. But right. Mr. Hanman was arguing that in particular we should have given notice and comment for the upper limit, because it changed what the formula was, which again is not correct. And again, this goes to the harmless error point, that even if we had changed the upper limit to what they wanted it, it wouldn't have had any impact in this case, let alone on petitioners. So I can walk through this quickly if you'd like me to try and explain that, or I can move on to it.
I suppose, but I would really like to know why EPA didn't give notice and comment here.
Well, the reason EPA didn't give notice and comment is because these were some very unique circumstances that EPA's never faced in over 25 years of NCPs. Again, we had a revised standard that didn't come into effect for 9 years. EPA asked companies back in February of 2010 if there was any company who was likely to be a technological laggard who was going to need NCPs. EPA didn't become aware until the fall of last year from Navistar that they were going to be likely to need NCPs because their credits were going to run out mm-hmm. early this year.
And that's why this became a problem, or
correct.
A more imminent problem. But you didn't know that was going to happen. The EPA didn't, back when they didn't give notice and comment.
EPA is under a mandate from Congress in Section 206G to issue certificates that have NCPs. That's their mandate. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to protect technological laggards. Congress didn't care.
How do you respond to your opponent's argument that Navistar, if I understand it, that Navistar had notice long in advance that they were going to run out of these credits and that they should have come forward earlier? Had they come forward earlier, you would have had time.
My response is that it's not relevant. When you're looking at the good cause exception and whether EPA should have provided notice and comment, what Navistar did and the actions it took and how long it took Navistar to notify EPA isn't relevant to the action that EPA then took to remedy the problem and specifically to be able to meet their congressional mandate. Congress didn't place blame in Section 206G on either the companies or on EPA. It just said EPA protect the technological laggards.
I'm sorry.
My question was, how do we even have a technological laggard here? They had 9 years. They have apparently produced this engine. They sell it in other places. They're not. How are they lagging?
There's actually some inaccuracies in that, too, Your Honor, that I'd like to clear up. First of all, this revised emission standard required a 95% reduction from the prior emission standard, which does require a substantial amount of work. But also, this isn't just like taking off one shoe and putting on another, as petitioner suggests. The technology that Navistar has in Brazil is technology that meets standards that are significantly more lax than the standards that are in the United States. So it's not just a matter of Navistar adding or taking away some piece of an engine. They actually have to recalibrate their software, redesign the engines, redesign the trucks. What's in Brazil is significantly different from what would be required in the United States. So it's a gross overstatement for petitioners to suggest that they can just transfer that technology here. And even if they could, there's still a significant amount of work to do.
That sounds like the sort of discussions that usually follow notice and come back from an agency after a notice and comment rulemaking. You know, we would expect EPA to say that if you'd given petitioners and everybody else in the world a chance to make their comments, and then you could have told them why they were wrong. We don't expect to have to come to court and work out the things that could have happened in notice and comment rulemaking.
I understand that, Your Honor, but again, in this
So why didn't they give notice on this, what they did here?
Because EPA
You could come in here and come up with this excuse, well, it just looks like it's a different upper limit, it didn't really change, you can go through this calculus problem and come to the same number. That's the kind of thing, again, you could have done a notice and comment, but to do it now...
Well, but again, EPA simply did not have time. We laid out in our brief that a rulemaking process...
I'm puzzled by, if I understand your point, that the fact that Navistar may have come late and may have had information long in advance that would have been useful to you, that doesn't figure into your calculus
It's
at
not
all?
EPA's job to punish Navistar if they cannot come to EPA, but the point is Navistar
Doesn't
is intended...
Doesn't that give all sorts of incentives to companies to lay in wait and...
Yeah. Having to pay a penalty is not
an
incentive.
Not, and that's not something that the EPA needs to take into account?
Not under its statutory mandate, no. And having to pay a penalty is not an incentive for these
Didn't they need to give notice and comment under 307B?
EPA determined in this case that 307 did not apply because we
Why
were going
didn't
to
it
use,
apply?
Because we were going to use the good cause exception. And 307D says...
Well, the good cause exception only comes in if it does apply.
The 307D says that if you're relying on the good cause exception, you cannot use the rulemaking requirements in 307. But again, just to get back to your point, Judge Sintel, the rulemaking process that we laid out in our brief was going to take 6 to 9 months. And when EPA found out about Navistar's credit shortage, it wouldn't have had time to go through that entire process before Navistar would have been out of credits. So EPA had to choose between either doing this temporary limited penalty, which that's what we have here, something that's of limited nature and duration.
How long has it been going on?
Has what been going on?
How long is this temporary?
Yeah, Mr. Hammond said that this is in effect for 2 years, which is technically correct, but two things. When EPA issues the final rule, it will supersede the certificates and the interim rule. So any certificates that Navistar has right now under the interim rule will be superseded by the final rule.
I understand that.
Okay.
But it's been 2 years since this has been in effect, right?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The interim rule came into effect this January.
Yeah.
And it will be in effect until
supersedes. How many credits do they have left? I couldn't figure out from the briefs how many credits they have left. And when do they run out of credits, and when is the time up? And
that's a bit of a complicated answer, but let me do the best I can. Okay. We don't have an exact number for the credits, and Navistar has not yet run out of credits because they have to use credits in California and some other states that don't accept NCPs. So they're still using those credits for those non-NCP states.
Right now, today, Navistar does not know when the credits will run out?
We do not have that. But if Navistar were not able to use NCPs today, starting today, they would run out of credits because they would have to use the credits that they're currently using for the California states. I see that my time is up, and I would just like to ask the court to look at the fact that the harm the petitioners claim here is that they would have otherwise gotten to basically steal the business that Navistar wouldn't have.
Steal is, why is that an appropriate word?
Because Congress did not want that to happen here under Section 20G6. They did not want companies like Navistar to be forced out of the marketplace. That's
You've
exactly
got a zero-sum game that Congress created, essentially. I mean, anything you take away from one competitor, you give into another. And to call it stealing, Counsel, that ill behooves the United States. They're imposing limitations on a free market, and then when somebody succeeds under those limitations anyway, that's not stealing.
I understand that, Your Honor, poor choice of words on my part, but their declarations do discuss.
Very poor choice.
Yes, I apologize. Their declarations do discuss being able to get a part of that business that Navistar wouldn't.
They didn't get up and accuse Navistar of stealing their business by having too cheap a deal made with the government, or the government
That's
being
correct.
Aiding and abetting and larceny, and that ill behooves the United States.
All right, I might apologize, Your Honor. Thank you very much for allowing me to take over my time. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Do you have any time left?
No time.
Give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Griff, to get to your question about credits, it's still surprising that Navistar and EPA don't know how many credits exist. And you'd think that has to be a critical component to figure out whether this was even required to go through a bypass notice and comment rulemaking. If you don't know when that D-Day event is, it's hard to justify to the rest of the competitors why the agency needs to bypass those process. I'd also point out that EPA itself, in that Dear Manufacturer letter at page 912 of the appendix, recognized that everyone was on target and Navistar didn't speak up then. As EPA confirmed in their letter denying our stay request, Navistar had all the credits they needed to get through model year 2012 as of 2010. But it's only because, and this is at footnote 9 of their letter, their sales doubled in 2011 that they find themselves in the predicament today. Now, they could have husbanded those resources more carefully. They knew that this was something looming on the horizon, but they didn't.
Is that proper rebuttal?
I'm sorry?
Is that proper rebuttal?
I believe it's responding to the point that Judge Griffith asked counsel. Yeah. But as luck would have it, I'm going to transition anyway to a new point. I'd like to talk about the reason why the formula did change and why that is an important aspect.
Now that's proper rebuttal. Go ahead.
And this gets to the question Judge Brown asked. Counsel is correct that the symbols that appear in the formula has remained the same, but they've redefined what one of those key symbols means. UL on the upper limit has been redefined. And I'm not a math genius myself, but I have tried to prepare for this situation. The equation for a circumference of a circle, pi times r squared, if you define the radius as suddenly the diameter, well, R is still going to be that, but it's going to completely change what that formula. So you haven't changed the formula. You're just saying what R now represents something else. That's what they've done, and you can see that actually at page 64 of the joint appendix, one page before what my colleague had represented. You'll see that EPA refers to the upper limit as one of the critical components of the formula. The formula clearly encompasses the upper limit. The formula is set forth in the regulations at 40 CFR 86.1113A. And you'll see that UL is one of the symbols that's incorporated into the formula. So if you change that, as they have indisputably done, you've changed how the formula is calculated, and therefore, under their own interpretation, required notice and comment. There are no other questions? Thank you.
Minutes and seeing no questions. The case will be submitted. Give us recess.